Earth Sky.
We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. I'm Jorge Salazar. We have stories this week on seeing an oil spill, insects in amber, illusions, and more. Here's a scientist soundbite.
I think that it's quite a transformative idea to people to imagine that there are dinosaurs all around us, that they're common, and that we know a lot about them. Birds are living dinosaurs.
That was bird expert Richard Prum of Yale University. More with Dr. Prum later, but first, a story on polio. For much of the industrialized world, polio might seem like a defliction of the past. But for a number of tropical developing nations, polio is still a health risk. According to a study released in late October 2010, scientists have created a new polio vaccine that they say could eradicate the disease in as little as 3 years. Here to tell us more is Earth Sky's Emily Howard.
That's right. Polio may very soon be snuffed out. This vaccine is currently in use in the 4 countries that have never gotten rid of polio. So that's India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. And it's been used there to great effect. Dr. Roland Sutter of the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, and lead author of this study, says that the new vaccine is more effective because it's bivalent. Now, what that means is that it only targets 2 of the virus's 3 strains, polio's type 1 and 3. Polio type 2, that's no longer a health concern. But that said, it was still included in past vaccines. And these older vaccines that immunized against all 3 strains, they require more doses. Dr. Sutter joins us to explain.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sutter, most of the industrialized world has had success with polio vaccines since the 1950s onward. Why didn't past polio vaccines work in developing nations?
It was never formulated for developing countries. And so you get much, much less per dose immunity in a tropical developing country with this vaccine than you do, for example, in the US, Western in Europe or elsewhere. So the bivalent gets you about 30 to 40% more immunity per dose. And that's really a big improvement.
Will you please share with us some of the numbers and statistics that reflect the success of these immunization campaigns?
Last year, we had in India 498 cases, almost 500 cases. This year, we have so far 39 cases. In Nigeria, last year to November, we had 382 cases, and at this point, we have 9 cases. So this has been quite dramatic decreases.
Thank you, Dr. Sutter. So, Jorge.
Yes.
In short, this new vaccine is more potent, so you need fewer doses, and it's targeted at the 2 strains that still pose the greatest health risk. So with that said, if all goes as planned, polio will be totally wiped out within the next 3 years.
Yeah, and that would be good news. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. Back after this. Sky, and we're heard 15 million times daily around the world on 1,500 radio stations, including Voice of America. We turn now to the science of illusions. On the line today, we have neuroscientist Mark Changizi, who's recently written a book called The Vision Revolution, how the latest research overturns everything we thought we knew about human vision. Dr. Changizi, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Why do we see illusions?
As a starting point, most people have seen these classical geometrical illusions, but just to get one of them in mind, let me describe the herring illusion. This is one of these that you have a bunch of spokes coming out of a point, just radially sort of coming out of a point, and then you have a vertical line going down the left side of the center and a vertical line going down the right side of the center. And what you actually perceive in this case is that the vertical lines don't look straight. They look like they're bowing outwards. when light hits your eye, you'd like to instantaneously create a perception of what the world is like. But the problem is that your brain can't instantaneously create a perception because your brain has to compute stuff, and it's got to just send the signal through actual distance to the back of your head. In fact, it takes about a tenth of a second to generate a perception of what was out there. And if you didn't do any corrections for that delay, then if I was moving at just 1 meter per second, then if I perceived something to be 10 centimeters from passing me, then by the time that perception actually happened, I would have already bumped into or have just passed the thing. So what your brain wants to do and would have been selected during evolutionary eras to do is to not try to generate a perception of what was out there when light hit the retina, but to guess how that world will be in a tenth of a second after that, because you want to anticipate the near future, because by the time you've generated a perception of that near future, the future will have arrived. That's half of the story. The other half of the story is, okay, when you have a bunch of spoke lines in this illusion that I described, when you move around in the world, your eyes actually take little snapshots. They don't sort of scan smoothly. They land on the spot, they take a little snapshot, and they saccade someplace else, and they take another snapshot. And if you're moving forward, then when you take that snapshot, you'll get optic flow that flows outwards from roughly the direction that you're going, kind of like when in Star Trek they go into warp and they get all this radial flow going outwards. And so when you have an image like this herring illusion that I described, where all these lines are emanating from a point, and you see it's not actually, there's no motion there, but your brain is happy to not see motion and yet infer it, because that's what it does all the time when it takes these little snapshots in the world. And so what it wants to do now that it knows what direction it's moving, it doesn't want to generate a perception of those two vertical lines as just being vertical lines. It wants to say how they will distort in a tenth of a second were I moving in that direction. So in the herring illusion, you actually see the bowing outwards even in the static thing, because your brain is desperately trying to anticipate the way the world is going to change in the next moment so that you have a perception of reality. In this case, of course, it's just a drawing on a piece of paper, so your brain has been tricked.
Neuroscientist Mark Changizi on the science of illusions. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
I need something in 3D. I need something in 3D. I need something in 3D.
We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Beth Lebwohl is here with an interview about dinosaur feathers.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. So I have to confess that this interview with feather expert Richard Prum of Yale University changed my life. Or at the very least, it changed the way I looked at birds. Here's what he said that did it.
Dinosaurs are all around us. They didn't go extinct. In fact, they're the most plentiful and diverse group of terrestrial vertebrates on the planet. You know, they are the birds.
We talked to Dr. Prum because in 2010, he became the first scientist to reconstruct the full plumage of a dinosaur in color. Here's Dr. Prum.
In literally the last 10 years, we've discovered that feathers originated in dinosaurs, evolved in the dinosaurs before the origin of birds and before the origin of flight.
So dinosaurs had feathers before they could fly. What did Dr. Prum say feathered dinosaurs looked like, Beth?
Well, first you should know that Dr. Prum based his work on the fossilized feathers of a dinosaur called, and this is a little difficult to say, Troodontid. It's a small, meat-eating, flightless dinosaur. He found evidence of black, gray, white, and red feathers.
We were able to use an electron microscope to image very, very tiny objects in the feathers of the fossil of this dinosaur. And when doing so, we discovered that there were tiny particles that had been preserved that were the original pigment granules that had been in the feathers of the animal when it was alive.
Prum said this dinosaur had the kind of coloration, patterns that is, that you might find on a particularly fine-looking turkey or chicken today. We actually have an image of this feathery creature on Earth Sky's website.
Okay, so we know what dinosaur feathers look like, but what did these dinosaurs use these feathers for?
Good question.
What they actually use them for and how they fit into the lives of dinosaurs is a little more problematic. Probably or possibly including things like thermoregulation, like controlling body temperature, insulation, or perhaps even display or protection from predators.
So did all dinosaurs have feathers?
No, actually. Just a particular class of dinosaurs called theropods.
Theropod dinosaurs are the bipedal, meat-eating dinosaurs that kids love. These are Velociraptor, Tyrannosaurus rex, Allosaurus, all those guys.
Interesting. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. We'll be right back. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. The U.S. space agency NASA used its satellites and aircraft to track the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico throughout 2010, and NASA continues to monitor its impact to the Louisiana coast. That's according to Michael Goodman, Natural Disasters Program Manager for NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center near Huntsville, Alabama. Here to talk more about NASA and the oil spill is Michael Goodman. Mr. Goodman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, NASA satellites and aircraft have tracked the Gulf oil spill of 2010 since day one. What would you say are the main findings from above of the oil spill?
We were able to monitor the progression of the oil spill from the initial blowout on April 20th and throughout the summer months through May, June, July, as the oil slick grew and spread and impacted the coastal ecosystems along the Gulf Coast. But in addition to our satellites, we utilized aircraft. We have several instrumented aircraft that provided a little higher resolution images, and we were able to distinguish areas where there were high concentrations of oil versus the thinner oil sheen that has much of a lower impact on the Gulf ecosystems. So it's important to identify and distinguish that the breadth and distribution of the oil sheen versus the thicker oil.
You've said that that NASA's observations of the Gulf oil spill aren't just for scientists, that the science has helped the public respond to the unfolding ecological disaster of the oil spill. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
NASA's satellite imagery and our aircraft data were not only used by scientists in monitoring the oil spill, but we also was provided to, that information provided to the emergency responders that were to help direct the authorities where to place the oil booms and direct the oil skimmers to clean up the effort. To get a sense of the sheer size and the magnitude of the oil slick, that was best conveyed to the public through the large-scale satellite images.
What would you say NASA has learned from its experience in monitoring the Gulf oil spill?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that, you know, we're using satellites to monitor our environment, and that's invaluable for detecting change. And that's what we're dealing with here. We're looking at change from the impact of the oil. So it's whether it's the short-term events like the Gulf oil spill or even longer-term effects like climate change scenarios, it's very important to have those sentinels in space, you know, the satellites that provide that global-scale view of our planet. The second thing I'd like to say is that, you know, NASA cooperated very well with our other federal agencies. We all worked together to develop new infrared spectroscopic methods for measuring the oil on the surface.
That was Michael Goodman of NASA on its monitoring of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. And now we have some weird science with Ryan Britton. He has a story about a snake that has reproduced by what the media is calling virgin birth.
Right. The scientific name is called parthenogenesis, and it's a form of asexual reproduction where a female uses only her own DNA, her own genes, to birth her own offspring. Recently, it was confirmed that a boa constrictor, so this is a giant snake, was successful in parthenogenesis.
So, Ryan, to back it up a second, you're saying that these snake babies had no snake daddy.
Right.
Are other animals capable of this?
So reproduction without a male is seen in other animals. Some insects can do it, and so can the Komodo dragon lizard. Scientists have also found evidence of more of this type of asexual reproduction in captive boa constrictors elsewhere.
So snakes might have been doing this all along, giving birth without a male.
Right, right. And there are certain risks with this reproduction without a male. Genetic mutations are far more common and can endanger the overall population. It's really an extreme form of inbreeding, and any harmful gene that is passed along will now have two copies. So this could definitely affect the conservation of other rare snakes.
So science needs to study this, but don't try this at home.
Right, right. We definitely need more details. You know, I'm particularly curious if the role of the male, even though he was in the aquarium, you know, there was no DNA in the offspring. So now I'm wondering if this poor male was just ignored by the female. Did she look at the guy and just say to herself, eh, I could do better?
So where can people find out more about this?
So you can find the story buzzing all over the internet, including NewScientist.com, LifeScience.com, MSNBC.com, among others.
And this is for real.
It's for real.
Thanks, Ryan.
Hey, you're welcome.
Weird Skies, Ryan Britton with Weird Science. Back after this.
Animal behaviors in the everyday, each and every city, state, county, country, avenue, and driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick, makes the human do the trick, earn the pay, procreate, and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. Lindsay Patterson joins us now in the studio.
Hey, Jorge.
Lindsay, what do you have to tell us today?
Well, I have a story about ancient insects trapped in 50 million-year-old amber deposits in western India. And they're revealing some pretty interesting things about India's geologic past. Basically, judging by the evidence of these insects, paleontologists are revising their view of where India was on the Earth 50 million years ago.
That sounds big. So tell us about these ancient insects.
Okay, so paleontologists mine the insects, primitive ants, bees, and spiders, out of these huge amber deposits. So if you recall from the movie Jurassic Park, amber is fossilized tree resin from ancient forests that insects tend to get stuck in, and they get preserved. David Grimaldi of the American Museum of Natural History was one of the paleontologists, and he told me what they found.
The amber contains a wealth of insect and plant and fungal remains. And we've found at least 1,000 pieces that contain insects so far, well over 100 species.
That's a lot of insects.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that all the insects were unknown to science before now.
Now, Lindsay, Dr. Grimaldi said that these insects are revising India's geological history. Can you tell us more about that?
So the thing is that while these insects are certainly unique, scientists over the years have found related species in other amber deposits all over the globe. But it was thought that 50 million years ago, India was totally isolated from any other landmass.
So Lindsay, what do you mean by India being isolated?
Well, India was on a 100 million year journey at the time, traveling on continental plates away from the supercontinent it had broken up with and towards Asia, where it eventually crashed into the continent and formed the Himalayas. Scientists thought that it docked, as they say, with Asia 50 million years ago, but the evidence of the insects now makes them think that it was sooner than they thought. Here's David Grimaldi again.
Well, we know that India definitely drifted away. There's no question that it was isolated. It just seems not to have been isolated for as long as people think. And it either docked with Asia earlier than geologists think, or there might have been some way that India was connected to Asia, not entirely, but maybe through island chains or peninsulas or something like that.
Lindsay, these insects in amber are telling scientists a lot about India.
They sure are. And by the way, they think that the insects were found in the oldest tropical forest now known on Earth.
Thanks, Lindsay.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Back after this.
Can we see the moonlight through the dark? Can we see the moonlight?
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird is here now to talk about the global night sky and the next blue moon. Deborah, what's up?
Jorge, that's right. In recent years, people have gotten really excited about blue moons. We have only one about every 2 to 3 years, and there's another one coming up November 21st, 2010.
Okay, so what exactly is a blue moon?
Well, in the 21st century, blue moon actually has two meanings. The blue moon coming up on November 21st is from the older definition. It's from the old Farmer's Almanac. It's the third of four full moons in a three-month period between the September 2010 equinox and the upcoming December solstice. So that's one definition. A blue moon is the third of four full moons in a season.
That sounds complicated for a blue moon.
It is, and it's one reason why in recent decades many people have begun using the name blue moon to describe the second full moon of a calendar month. And we won't have another one of those until the year 2012 on August 31st.
And we're expecting a blue moon in November. Tell us more. When is that?
Okay, that'll be November 21st. If you go outside that night from anywhere around the globe, you can see a full or almost full moon, and that will be the blue moon.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. And you know, people can visit the Tonight section of EarthSky.org for more about blue moons and about the global night sky.
EarthSky's Deborah Bird. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on EarthSky. This week's show was recorded at the EarthSky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Brian Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, Sleep Good, Dana Falconberry, Built by Snow, and Mellow Grand. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.